Final session of a series that we've had here on the future of the earth. And this time I'm going to talk a little bit about something that I call 21st century studies. And by way of introduction to this subject, I want to tell you about a surprise embarrassment that I had the other night, in which I was presented an award. This was organized and arranged by Dan Erlander and Mike. And it says here, Holden Village First Annual Award, in very large letters. And then under that it says, for using the kingdom of the left for the sake of the kingdom of the right. And at the bottom, it says, Super Ubi Sububi, or Semper Ubi Sububi. And on the back, it says, presented to Gerald O'Barney on this 27th day of July in the year of our Lord, 1988, Elmer Witt, director, please do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. Let not your right hand know what your left hand is doing. Well, the occasion for this award, or the inspiration for it, I guess, was that I described how I had used the opportunity afforded by the Global 2000 study in the kingdom of the left in government to promote attention to what I think, in part, the kingdom of the right is wanting us to give some more attention to. That is a question of justice in the world and whether it is possible for everybody in the world to live as high and comfortably as we do, and if not, then whether or not some question of redistribution is in order if we're to think seriously about the question of justice. And I think this was, I know this was in large part in jest, but on the other hand, I think that both Dan and Mike and Elmer and many others feel that it is entirely appropriate for us as Christians to be looking for opportunities to use the legitimate interests of government in a way that gives attention to and gives credence to the needs, the interests, the goals of the kingdom of God. And what I want to talk about today is the way in which I and a few colleagues are continuing that kind of effort in what we call the Institute for 21st Century Studies. And before I forget, let me say that when the bus leaves at right after lunch today, I am hoping that I will not be in possession of a bunch of these papers. And so there's some things here that I'd like to tell you exist, and then some of you who would like to have them afterward, you can come and get them. One is a description, a brief description of our institute, and with it there's a list of the countries that have 21st century studies in progress. There's also, in here someplace, a copy of an article that I wrote for a theological journal called Word and World, and it is a discussion of, the title is The Future of the Creation, the Central Challenge for Theologians. It's kind of a theological interpretation of the implications of the Global 2000 study, and I think those are the main two things. There are a couple things I'm going to put in the library, too. So if any of you would like copies of either of those, and I hope there will be a few of you at least, that will lighten my load going out and increase yours. Well, let me say just a few words about what the Global 2000 study was and what these 21st century studies are. President Carter asked that a study be done of the probable changes in the world's population, environment, economy, resources, out to the year 2000. And the study that I directed required 3 years. Virtually every part of government was involved in doing it. And it was a marvelous experience in one way of being able to ask virtually any question that I wanted to know an answer to about the world and have the entire resources of the federal government at my command almost to work on this. It was a difficult challenge in that they didn't exactly always respond right away to my commands. And in fact, it got to be quite a task to get people to cooperate and get the work done. In the end, what emerged is that it's kind of a patched picture of the world. It says that some parts of the world are likely to do very well. It says that other parts of the world are not likely to do very well. And probably the part of the world that's in most trouble is the Sahelian African countries, the part just south of the Sahara, where population growth and has led people to try desperately to get adequate food and nourishment from a very fragile environment, and as a result, there's been enormous damage done to the environment, and the Sahara is moving south at maybe 15, 20 miles per year. And in the process, the very conditions are being created in which it's hardest to get people to think about wanting fewer children. People want surviving children. And the conditions are so bad that infant mortality rate is very high. And there's no possibility for women to get educated and have some different role in life other than bearing children and trying to feed and sustain a family. So the two things that are most necessary to bring population growth rates down, namely education for women and reduced infant mortality rates, are very hard to achieve there. And the study suggests that those kinds of trends are likely to continue short of some major changes of policy. The study looked at population, employment opportunities, economic things. It looked at a wide range of things in a very integrated way. And most studies don't have the degree of integration of the amount of data in them that this study did. And it, as a result, attracted quite a lot of attention. It sold 1.5 million copies in, I guess, 8 languages now. And as a result of its publication and its wide distribution and discussion, a lot of other countries have begun thinking that they would like to do a similar kind of study looking at their own future. And representatives of countries have begun coming to me asking for help doing a study like this. The first country to come was Canada. And I actually went up to Canada and worked with the Canadians and wrote a book for them about the future of Canada and comparing that with the U.S. view of Canada. And we learned a lot in the process of doing that. And probably the most important thing was what we learned about generating real interest in the future in a country from which I am not, I'm not a citizen. The work that we did attracted a lot of political attention, a lot of headlines, for about 6 weeks, and then there was nothing. You know, it's just completely forgotten. And it was dismissed in large part because it was a foreign view. It was not a Canadian view of the future of Canada. And so I started trying to use a different approach. And the next opportunity came in the People's Republic of China. And there was no possibility, anyway, of an American doing a study of China. It simply wouldn't be accepted at all. So I used a different strategy. I worked with a man who wanted to get a study done in China. He set up the team. I trained the team. I worked with him in developing the study plan. And they did the work. You know, I had some other people come and spend a year working with me in Washington. I arranged for the leader, Mr. Lin, to come and give some talks in the U.S., travel around, meet people, learn things here. But it was not my study. In the end, the book does not even, or the report does not even acknowledge my involvement. And that had to be politically, because the report was saying some pretty, well, for that time, it was a pretty dangerous kind of thing to do in China. Mr. Lin headed an organization called the Institute for Scientific and Technological Information for China. It's kind of like the Library of Congress, only just the technical part of the Library of Congress, but with the additional responsibility of providing technical, you know, science and technology policy advice to the government. And you know, that part, the policy advice, had always been a very low-level kind of thing until Mr. Lin came there, and he was much more interested in that aspect and developed it. When he put this team together, 10 people, all he did was pick a couple of people who had been putting books on the shelf and things of that sort. Not real high-class professionals, but he took 10 of his staff and put them aside in a room and said, "Now, you're going to work with me for however long it takes, and we're going to do a study of the future development of our country." Now, the premier, shortly before, had announced that China was going to quadruple its gross national product by the year 2000. So they took that as kind of a starting point in doing the analysis. And as they did the analysis, they included some things that had never been looked at very carefully before in China. One of them had to do with per capita resource availability. That was one that I had insisted on in the study outline, and it proved ultimately to be very, very important. Up until the time of the study, China in the year 2000, which Mr. Lin did, China had never, ever looked at its resources in any way other than the total amount of resources. And being such a big country geographically, China, of course, has got huge amounts of resources. But when you divide by the number of people that are there and get a resource per capita figure, and when you compare that with other country, China doesn't look nearly as good as when you just look at the gross total number of tons of copper or whatever it may be. So in the end, they had a report that said, if you're going to try to quadruple GNP, that means you're going to have to quadruple transportation. And there's a certain amount of energy required for transportation. There's a certain amount of energy required for building houses and, you know, all the other things that go on in an economy. And when you think about trying to quadruple the amount of energy production in China, you simply couldn't imagine how that could be done at all, let alone by the year 2000. So indirectly, Mr. Lin was telling the premier that there was no way that his plan would ever be achieved. And in China, in the early 80s, that was not a very safe thing to do. Mr. Lin got intensely criticized, and it looked for a time as though he was even going to be thrown out of the Communist Party for doing this, for raising the question, number one, but even worse, for using Western analytical methods to raise the questions, that it was just grossly unfair to compare China with the rest of the world using Western methods of analysis. Well, the final decision about Mr. Lin's fate was made ultimately by Premier Chao the man who had put forward the goal. And in a public speech, he said that this study was very important and that we had to learn how to apply Western methods of analysis. We had to apply them in a way that fit the Chinese circumstance. But we had to learn from these things as well, and the work should be improved. Now, there proved to be an opportunity there for Mr. Lin to take an action that I think I would not have the wisdom to take. When the premier of your country says the work you've been doing is very important and should be continued and improved, my instinct would be to rush right in and say, I'll do it. Mr. Lin didn't. He backed away entirely. And in rushed the political climbers, the people who want to make big careers for themselves in politics. And they took over his study. And they have done lousy work. It's just dreadful. Compared to his, they spent much more money and have produced nothing of anywhere near the significance of his work. But the thing that they've done that was so important is they made his work part of the establishment. Now, by backing away from it entirely himself and letting the political climbers embrace it and take it over, the work that he did became mainstream. And it has really changed China. If he had rushed in and said, I'm going to keep this myself, that never would have happened. And I don't know that I would have the wisdom that he had to see the importance of letting go and letting somebody else take it, even though they were going to do a bad job with it, because it would give credibility to what had gone before. So there is one more case where a big change came about as a result of one of these studies. After China, I guess one of the next ones that came along as an opportunity was Mexico, and then Iceland, and there are several countries in Europe, and Taiwan, and we're one of a very, very small number of organizations that's ever been able to work at the same time with both mainland China and Taiwan, with both sides knowing that we were doing that. The way these opportunities come up, it can be illustrated in a way by what happened in Iceland. There's a graduate student that I had known from Iceland that was working on water policy. And he wanted to get a job at the World Bank, but that didn't pan out, so he'd gone back to Iceland, and he invited me to come see him. And I was had to make a trip to Europe, and so on the way back, I flew Icelandic Air and stopped in Reykjavik. And he met me at the airport, which doesn't sound too unreasonable, until you know how far the airport is from Reykjavik. It's about an hour's drive or a little more. The best flight I could get, in fact, the only flight I could get, arrived at 3 in the morning. And I thought I was astonished to find him there waiting for me at the airport. And as he drove me around 3:30 or 4 o'clock to the hotel, he said we had an appointment next morning at 8:30 with his uncle. And I wasn't thinking too positively about that idea. And I said, well, okay, who's your uncle? Well, he's the prime minister. So I set the alarm. And we had breakfast together at 7:30, and at 8:30 we were in the prime minister's office for a 30-minute appointment. And actually I was there about 45 minutes because he got interested in these studies. I gave a talk there the next day that had already been arranged, and after the end of the talk, the Prime Minister said, would you mind if I got a few people together and we could talk a little more about these kinds of studies? So I think that was on a Friday evening, and I was leaving Sunday afternoon. Sunday morning, he had a brunch at the Prime Minister's residence, and virtually everybody who was anybody in Icelandic politics was there, and we talked about the idea of a 21st century study for Iceland. And next time he gave a major political speech, he announced that it was getting started. Now, that's an example of how one of these things can happen. It's also an example of what can go wrong with the study, because in the political process, the people who got chosen to lead the study and to be a part of it were kind of the old line mentality, and I'd say of all of the studies that are in progress, that one has probably proved to be the least useful. It just, all of the important questions have been avoided. And the man who is leading the study really resisted any kind of involvement from our institute, would not let us work with him in framing questions. He didn't want important questions really raised. So it's a pretty weak study. It has not been finished. I'm doubtful that it'll ever will be finished at this point. And it is not really proven as useful.
In Mexico, questions are important.
Well, in yeah, in Iceland, the real important questions have to do with stewardship of the resources. When people first settled Iceland, it was a forested, fertile island. And their first economy was based on timber. And they cut all the timber. It was clear cut. And in that very, well, fairly cold climate way north, with a lot of wind and so forth, it's just not been possible to get the forest to grow back. They did get some grass to grow, but there was a lot of erosion in the process, so a good bit of the natural fertility of the island was lost when they lost their forest, when they cut it and didn't replant it and didn't do anything about protecting the soil. So the next major economy of Iceland was sheep, and they built up a fantastic sheep industry, or had a fantastic sheep industry. It a lot of grazing, and somehow the sheep that they grow have remarkable properties of wool. It's long staple to start with, but it's really high quality wool, and the meat of the sheep they grow is also very good. Icelandic lamb is about as good a lamb meat that you'll get anywhere. It's really remarkable. But they've overgrazed, badly overgrazed, and further accelerated the erosion. And of all the places where there is soil now, they have reduced it down to bare rock for about 60% of what used to be fertile land. You know, they've lost 60% of what was their fertile land, and now what's left is looks like a moonscape. I mean, it's really bad stuff. Well, there's still pressure to keep. They've got limits now set on how many sheep you can have, but there's pressure to keep raising that and or not to lower it. And they're continuing to erode and destroy their what's left of their fertile land. Well, the next resource that they went after was fish. Iceland is located right square in the middle of what is probably the richest ocean fishery in the world. And they have developed a fleet of fishing vessels that are extraordinary. They started years and years ago going out in hand-rowed boats. And some of the stories the Icelanders have to tell about that, those early days of fishing and the paintings. You know, we've been talking about here about great skill and the best of the media and so forth, but lacking content. Icelandic art is fantastic. I just love to see those paintings of their fishing. And they've got some sculptors in Iceland that are just marvelous. love to go there and go to their museums. But as time went on, they got technology, and they've got now some of the most sophisticated boats in the world, radars and, you know, or sonars rather, and all kinds of techniques to find the fish. And they're harvesting the fish at a phenomenal rate. And the stocks are going down. They've gone down badly. And the high quality fish stocks are down to the point where they're just not getting much at all on them. The lower quality fish stocks, like cod, have been holding up fairly well until recent years, and even those now have plummeted. But they want to keep building more boats. They want to keep the limits up as to how much they can fish, and they don't want to support research as to what the fishing stocks are. The universities have got research programs, but the government won't buy them boats. They have to go get permission to ride along on the fishing boats in order to go out and do research. So it's all of those kinds of questions that should be addressed, and the current study isn't addressing them at all. There is a potential for one other major new resource development there, and that's thermal energy. Iceland has got almost all of the heating in Iceland is done by hot water. I was there in November when the sun would come up around 10:30 and it began to get dark about 2, and went swimming in an Olympic-sized swimming pool right in the middle of downtown Reykjavik. It's all open. There's no roof on it. And it's nice and toasty warm, you know. And with freezing rain falling on your head as you swim, and pools around the sides that are, some of them are too hot to get into. You know, it's all there. But they have a tremendous amount of thermal energy there that they can exploit. But they're not really dealing with that.
Are the Icelandic people the only ones to fish in their waters, or they have competition with a lot of the nations?
Well, you know, there's territorial limits that within which they control the fishing. And it's been, well, up until about 10 years ago, the territorial limits were, I think, 60 miles, and they've been extended to 200 miles.
Oh, yeah.
So they've got an enormous area over which they really have control. Pretty well. I think they've got some agreements with other countries to get in there, as well as, I think, both the U.S. and the Soviets fish it, but they're not dealing with those issues at all, really. But some of the other studies are doing much better. Mexico is...
I was going to digress from where you're heading, but
sure.
Somewhere along the way, I'd like you to give some little analysis of what you see for the future of Mexico, since they are our close neighbor and seem to be in some difficulty.
I'll talk about that then. Yeah, you want to...
Yeah, what is the energy source for Iceland up there? Do they use? Do they have coal, oil, or whatever?
They import oil.
So they're having import.
Yes.
To get their energy.
I think Iceland currently has the highest per capita income of any non-oil producing country in the world. There, Volvos and Mercedes are, you know, they're all over up there. It's a really rich country, very rich. In part due to the interest of the U.S. of having a base there. There's an enormous U.S. base there. So Iceland is located right in the middle of the waterway that the Soviets have to use to get their submarines in and out of the Soviet Union. And the U.S. has planted sensors all over the bottom of the ocean and has an enormous computer facilities there for analyzing all the sonar and other information that they get. The Icelanders don't even know what the U.S. is doing there. The U.S. will not allow them even to look at what's going on there. But they get some financial benefits out of this, too. Well, let's go to Mexico. I've been interested in and been visiting Mexico for many years, and have been troubled by the lack of reality among Mexicans about the situation they face. There have been many studies about the future of Mexico. De La Madrid, the current president, will be leaving office soon. Before he became president, he directed a big study of the future of Mexico called Plan Global, or the Global Plan. And for the most part, it reads something like, Mexico is a wonderful country. We have a great future. We have wonderful people. And that's about all there is to it. There's really no substance. And what substance there is was kept in documents that were not made available to the public. So you really don't have any serious understanding of it. My located in Mexico City, headed by a man named Victor Urquidy. Victor has a record, I think, unsurpassed by any Mexican person involved in policy work, in that he has served under 5 Mexican presidents, and almost nobody managed to survive from one to the next, and he's survived under 5. And he introduced me to a little organization called the Fundación Javier Barros Sierra, a foundation named after a man who had been a minister of science and technology and had received a big prize and decided to use that prize to establish a foundation for what we might call prospective or futures research. And as typical with too many Mexican plans, they had very grandiose ideas. They built a building on a beautiful campus-like place and started recruiting a staff, and they got up to about 120 people, got into some financial difficulty, and had to reduce the staff from 120 to 12, including the groundskeeper. At that time, which was, I guess, about 6 years ago, a fellow who had been in the engineering department at the National Autonomous University was there starting a sabbatical. He had left the position of kind of deputy dean to have a sabbatical at this fundación. And all of a sudden, the day after he arrived, the whole place fell apart and everybody got fired. Well, he was still there on support from the university. And so the board of directors turned to him and asked him to become the director. He was the 7th director in 6 years for this institution, and has been director ever since. I met with him shortly after he took over, about 6 months after he had taken over, and he'd used the first 6 months to try to untangle the books for the organization. There were just tremendous accounting financial problems, and it had taken him 6 months to sort that out. And he was then trying to figure out a program, and I proposed to him that he do a serious study of the future of Mexico. And that's been going on now for about 4 years. And it has proven to be extremely powerful and effective. His approach is unlike anything I would have chosen. I would have had a put together a model, and I'd have made projections and analyzed different policy options and things of that sort. He didn't. He said, in Mexico, our government is so strong, the party is so strong. You know, it's a one-party nation. The institutional revolutionary party, or PRI, and is the Mexican acronym, Spanish acronym, really runs Mexico. The president, in fact, picks the next president. You know, so, and tremendous amount of corruption in the government as well. It's very hard to fight that. So what Antonio, this man's name is Antonio Alonso, what he proposed is a way of working was to find the best intellectuals in the nation and get them to be part of teams to prepare various parts of the report. And by having such high-quality people involved, and so many high-quality people involved, the government would not, and the party would not be able to ignore the work. You would have some people from the party, but many people who are not a part of the party as well. And the technique has worked fairly well, with a few glitches. One is that when you get a bunch of hotshot intellectuals together, they're glad to be there in name, but they don't do anything. And he had counted on them contributing a great deal, and they didn't. So he and his very meager staff have had to do a lot of more of the analysis. But it's been done in such a way, and with enough meetings with the senior intellectuals of the nation, that they continue to put their name on it. So although most of the work was really done by Antonio and his people, It has the appearance, politically, of having been done by the top intellectual leaders of Mexico. And the timing has been good. The president, I guess about a year ago, De La Madrid, announced his candidate, Carlos Salinas, to be the next president. And with that announcement, then the election campaign gets underway. It goes on for a year, and it's during that 1 year that all really serious discussion of public policy takes place. Once the actual election takes place and the PRI candidate is in fact elected, as always takes place, then serious discussion of public policy ends and the party goes on and does whatever it's going to do. Well, this study got done at the right time to be an active part of that, and was such a significant influence that the PRI candidate appeared on a two-hour-long television or televised talk show in which people from all over Mexico could call in and talk with the presidential candidate. And he was there talking about the Future of Mexico study that I've helped Antonio prepare, and it's had a very positive and impact. One of the major problems in Mexico is that the valley in which Mexico City is located is much like Los Angeles. It's a valley-shaped kind of thing, and it gets inversions. And you can't get rid of the pollution. So Mexico City has some of the most polluted air that you'll find anywhere in the world. I've been up early in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, gone out, and the air is so dirty that it's the top of the hotel is kind of indistinct because of all the soot, smoke in the air. It's really bad. The water is also a serious problem. You know, and it's not just the water quality, and in fact you get sick from the water, but that there's such a limited amount of water. You have to pump water up over the mountains and get it into Mexico City. And most people there, the water's on, there's water pressure at all, only for a couple of hours per day, and most people put a big tank up on top of their house, and when the water is running, they pump water up there, and then during the rest of the day, they just draw water out of that tank that's up on top of their house. Another big problem is that the water has come, in large part, from wells. Mexico City was built on a lake bed, and they pumped all the water out of the lake, and they just kept going, and now the wells are very, very, very deep. They're contaminated with sewage, and as the water gets pumped out, the city sinks, and there's tremendous subsidence problems. The roads are broken and twisted, bridges are twisted and bent, and earthquakes take place there all the time. It's the only place in the world I've ever been where you check in. They give you a piece of paper that tells you what to do when the earthquake comes, because there are so many earthquakes. I had a meeting co-sponsored with the Mexican team of all of the 21st century study teams. We met in Mexico City, and we adjourned our meeting and left just 10 days before the earthquake that devastated Mexico City. And the building that we were in, the hotel we were in, did not come clear to the ground, but was so badly damaged that everything had to be torn down. Across the street, in fact, for several blocks, every single building came down where we were. And the study team, led by Dr. Alonzo, abandoned their work at that time and asked themselves, what can we do to help, and decided that what they would do is take one of their PC microcomputers, go into the center of Mexico with a motor generator set, and set up a database of missing persons. And they were the ones who collected all of the basic data on how many deaths took place in that earthquake, and also put families back in touch with each other and so forth. So they were directly involved in that. But one of the big problems with Mexico, what time is it getting to be here? I'm talking a little longer than I intended to, but I'll just finish this story up a little bit. One of the big problems with Mexico is that all of the power, all of the opportunity for wealth center around the president. And if you want to go anywhere in Mexico, you want to be anybody or do anything or make a fortune for yourself, you've got to be in Mexico City. And that city is already it's the biggest city in the world, and one of the most rapidly growing cities in the world. It's hard to believe. It's bigger than metropolitan New York, bigger than Tokyo, but with no sewage system. And with all these other problems, it's hard to imagine a more nightmarish situation, and also hard to imagine any way in which you can stop the growth of the city, because everybody wants to be close to the president, or close to the people who are close to the president, because that's where you make money. So the rest of Mexico really doesn't grow very much at all. There are a couple of other cities that have been kind of limping along, sometimes doing better than others. There's Cuernavaca, Guadalajara, and one other that I'm blocking on. But there are two other industrial cities in Mexico that have got potential for growth, but the taxation and the opportunities are just such that those cities don't grow the way Mexico does. Well, the study team has, for the first time that I have ever heard of, raised what I think has to ultimately be the answer to this plight of Mexico City. They have proposed that the government move out of Mexico City. And this is an absolutely revolutionary kind of idea, and it's the kind of thing that would have you dismissed as completely off your head. But for the fact that there are so many high-level, highly respected intellectuals involved with this study, and also because they have assembled a database on a 20 megabyte hard disk on a microcomputer that is far better than any database in the entire Mexican government. So these people have got the information, they've got the intellectual backing, they're just doing a super, super job. Now, what'll happen, I don't know. But Alonso is close now to the new presidential candidate. He's met with him, he knows him. The president's father is on Antonio's board of directors, and so there's a good possibility for interaction there. We'll just have to see. But never before has there been a really serious substantive study of the future of Mexico that dealt with some of the most fundamental issues that are involved. And that, I think, is going to be a study that potentially could have the kind of impact that the China study has had. So, in brief, what we're trying to do is to encourage nations all over the world to do these kinds of studies. Politically, there's an opportunity now that doesn't come along very often for there to be some political capital in being far-sighted. The year 2000 is not very far away, and if you think about what Time magazine is going to look like in December 1999, you know, it's going to be all about the 21st century. And if a political leader now begins doing the homework and preparing the foundations for being able to say some thoughtful things about the 21st century, there's an opportunity to kind of make some political capital out of being far-sighted. That's usually not the case for politicians. There are costs rather than benefits about being far-sighted. But it's also a tremendous opportunity for people involved with the Kingdom of the Reich, as my friends call it, with God's Kingdom, to be involved in encouraging people to think more carefully about issues of justice and how you change society in such a way that it can become a more just society. We can take some steps toward the redemption of the society. And that basically is what the Institute for 21st Century Studies is trying to do. So let me stop there, and we've got a few minutes yet to see what questions. Yes, sir?
In the beginning, I don't know if I'm saying this right, but you indicated that we should be working toward helping a lot of these people, or our efforts should be, or we should be concerned about it, and other countries should be concerned about it. But then you mentioned places like Mexico with the corrupt government, and you know, I understand huge wealth went into there during the oil crisis, and very little ever got out of the people. That's my understanding of it. I don't know if that.
I think that's true.
They made a lot of fat cats in Mexico City, probably. They did very well. And I think with our Ethiopian efforts, we had difficulty through their government even trying to get things that we sent down there to the people because of the government. That really, because of some of these governments, it makes this task extremely difficult. And I don't know, how are we going to get around that?
Well, I don't know if we can get around it, but I think we have to try. And the way I think you have to try is to try to get the facts. Try to understand how the system works, how the fat cats get so fat. And let the people know how the fat cats are getting so fat. That's basically what I think you have to do. And that's going to take more courage than our government usually has. And that's why I don't think you can really count on our government, on the State Department or AID, to really be dealing with those kinds of issues. But it also takes a lot of sophistication. You got to know how bankers work. You got to know how Mexican lawyers work. You got to know how the police work in Mexico, and you know, all those kinds of things. Just, you know, Mexico is just one place, and things work differently in every other country that you go to. So there's a lot of homework involved.
Sounds like your organization that comes in the back door might be more effective than. The government's trying to deal with governments.
I think in dealing with the fundamental issues, we've got a technique that has a lot of potential. I really do. And we're started early enough so that we can take advantage of this, you know, once in a century, or once in a millennium opportunity that the year 2000 presents. I mean, that's a public relations opportunity that that doesn't come around very often. Yes, sir?
I have a question that whether you have any information on this, whether you have a study on this, of starvation throughout the world. Got any statistics on when the things are so bad that the starvation, farmers is in a bad shape. We've got a surplus now, but that is going to end. Then there's going to be a starvation. I was wondering whether you had any information on that.
Well, the whole food situation is is a complicated one. It involves technology. It involves different countries. The food situation is different. It's not an easy one to give a short, quick summary of. The chapter in the Global 2000 study that discusses food, I think, is still one of the best things around. That report is now out of print from the government printing office, but it's still available from Penguin Books, so you can get that and look at it.
In 1971, we was in the Florida Convention, and they predicted then that 2015 starvation throughout the world.
Well, I don't have much confidence in predictions that say there's going to be starvation all over the world. It's going to come in pockets. There's always going to be ways in which the rich people are going to eat pretty well. I don't think there's going to be mass starvation. Short of, if we get this big climate change, where the Midwest simply no longer can grow crops because it's too dry and too hot, that could make the world food situation pretty grim. Some other questions or comments? Here's one. No, that was a stretching of the arm. Yeah.
In some of these studies around the world, what role is nuclear energy playing in the analysis of what direction to go in the future?
Well, I'd say almost everywhere, nuclear energy is one of the options that's being considered. And in some places, it's regarded as the option to pursue. Japan has gone very strongly in that direction. Taiwan is planning to. But there are other parts of the world, Norway and Sweden in particular, where they've decided no nuclear energy at all. Overall, in the United States, there hasn't been a nuclear power plant started or approved, I guess, for probably 15 years. And in part, that has come from some wildly exaggerated projections of how much energy was going to be needed. In part, it has come about as a result of the conservation measures that got put into effect when the oil prices went up. And in part, it's come about as a result of people discovering technology for getting far more benefit out of a given amount of energy. It's becoming more of an issue. Do you remember the issue of all the radioactive contamination that took place from the X-ray machine? Do you remember that at all? Yeah. I guess it was a U.S. Cancer treatment machine got shipped to Mexico, and it was never used, because the Mexicans couldn't figure out how to use it, and then it got sold for scrap. And the scrapyard, somebody took it apart, and inside they found this powder, which I've forgotten what it may have been. I don't think it was plutonium, but it was some very highly radioactive material. What was it? Yeah, I think you're right. Cobalt 60, and. Kids were playing with it, and it was kind of glowed in the dark, and they got it on their hands, and they ate their sandwiches, and tracked all over, and they had a disaster, a real disaster with that stuff. It got mixed into to steel that was being produced, and the way in which it was, the problem was discovered, if I remember right, is that they made some steel and shipped it up here, and a truck that was carrying it got lost and went through a radiation detector around a nuclear weapons plant. And there was a camera there that took a picture of the back of the truck. So they got the license number of this truck. And then the police tracked it down and stopped it and found out it was carrying very radioactive steel. Now the questions came out, well, where did the steel come from? And they found the place that it had come from. And then they went to where the scrap came from that was put into the steel and it came to the scrap yard. And then they found that place was very radioactive. And lots and lots of people were badly injured with that. And people continue to worry, you know, is there some of that stuff in my yard? Because they found it all along streets and all over the place. Well, that accident, that disaster, really increased Mexican awareness of the dangers of radioactivity. But still, by and large, the poverty is so bad in Mexico that people are willing to do almost anything to get some income. Yeah.
Do you visualize, I think some demand's picking up electricity here in the United States again, kind of levelized when people are doing all the conservation, but now they're coming back.
Growing again.
You think that, and coal has been the big thing now, new plants have been put in coal plants, do you think there's going to, it's going to switch maybe from coal back to nuclear, or do you think coal is going to continue to be the way that, or...
Well, neither coal nor nuclear is ideal. You know, they're not. Coal's got the problem of carbon dioxide emissions and possible changing of the climate, as does petroleum. Coal produces a lot of ash and you know, it kills miners. There's a lot of problems with coal. Nuclear's got an unresolved problem of the waste disposal, and an inherently unresolvable problem of a very high risk or a very high damage potential for a low risk. I mean, the probability of there being a nuclear accident like Three Mile Island or Chernobyl is not high. But when it happens, boy, you got a real mess. And I don't think that there's any way in which that part is ever going to go away. So for nuclear to really go again or be a major source, I think we're going to have to give a lot more attention to the waste disposal problem. And we're going to have to... do much more than has been done to date about making the technology inherently safe. And I think the Canadians and the Japanese have probably gone a lot further in that direction than we have. And if it does, nuclear industry does go again, I suspect that those two countries are going to have a good share of our market for reactors. On the coal side, one development that hasn't really gotten the papers yet, but there's an interesting one, is that an idea has been proposed for pollution control from carbon dioxide. Now, there's so much carbon dioxide produced that nobody could ever figure out how you would trap that. You know, take a balloon of enormous proportions to catch all the carbon dioxide. But a property or a characteristic of carbon dioxide emissions is that once they go into the atmosphere, it's only a matter of a few days, and you can't tell whether that carbon dioxide came from Australia or whether it came from Nome, Alaska. And it spreads all over the globe very quickly. So your pollution control device doesn't have to necessarily be right next to the power plant. A friend of mine was contacted by a power company that wanted to do something responsible with a new power plant they were putting in, and asked, can you come up with any idea of how to control carbon dioxide emissions? And his solution was, put it right into the air and put a carbon dioxide catcher someplace else. I said, well, what's that? Well, let's build a forest in some developing country. And he did the calculations and found that you could plant and take care of a forest in a developing country big enough to absorb the amount of carbon dioxide produced by a power plant, for something like 3 to 5% of the cost of the power plant. So this one power company is now looking into the possibility of growing a forest as a way of taking as much carbon dioxide out of the environment as their power plant would put in. And if that approach works, it would provide a wonderful incentive to help the developing countries put their forests back in order, and would also help reduce the impact of this greenhouse effect.